Round 2, Bubbles and Brisket 2022.
That's right, it's the second annual Bubbles and Brisket, brought to you by the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast, coming to you at Smoky Hollow in downtown Raleigh.
This year we have 11 Q chefs doing their take on brisket, and 21 different sparkling wines and champagne.
And not to mention that, we're also doing beer by Crafton.
Hey! Yeah.
And non-alcoholic beverages from Devil's Foot Beverage and Orangina.
Plus, we have desserts from Bestow Baked Goods and Bold Batch Creamery.
Our friend Sam Suchoff of Lady Edison Ham is just going to be slicing delicious ham, because why not?
Hey, wait, do I have to pay for everything separately?
No, it's all inclusive, Matt. You get one ticket, one price, all the fun, by just going to our website, ncfbpodcast.com. Early bird tickets are on sale for $65 until April 30th. Then they go up on May 1st to $75. So act now to get your tickets. Brought to you by the NCFB and U.S. Foods,
Triangle Wine Company,
Raleigh Magazine,
Food Scene,
and Devil's Foot Beverage Company.
Bubbles and Brisket on June 4th from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m.
This is the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. Thank you for listening, subscribing, and hitting subscribe on your friend's phone without them knowing. Coming to you live from the Zoom closet in the beautiful kitchen studios in downtown Raleigh. This episode is sponsored in part by Spot On, tech that helps your business grow. Request a demo at spoton.com. And Joe Van Gogh Coffee, serving the community from seed to cup. And now, they put the rest in the restaurant industry. It's Max Trujillo and Matthew Weiss.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss. And today on the show, we have coming to us live from New York City, unbeknownst to him, a mentor to me in my wine career. This man is the wine wizard, and he is the chief critic, the chief wine critic of the New York Times, and that is one Eric Asimov. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here.
It's quite an honor. I mean, your name has been spoken many, many times in the wine industry where Matt and I both have kind of grown up. Me being from the West Coast and Matt from the East, your name travels well, even all the way out to L.A. Even those L.A. Times readers even know something about what you write.
You know, it helps to have the big last name, New York Times.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't take it too personally or get too self-congratulatory about it.
You know, no pun intended, or maybe there was a pun intended, but the last name there, let's dive into that for a second. And there's so much I want to dive into, and I might just shut Max's mic off. He might not know because I have so many questions. But
that's fine.
You're a writer. You come from a family of writers, your sister, and most notably, your uncle is Isaac Asimov. And Max, in the background here, you can't see, but has his new Apple TV series, or the Apple TV series based on his famous novel Foundation coming up. So I have to imagine that was somewhat of an inspiration for you. Did that put you on your career path as a writer?
Not overtly. I mean, I think that, you know, I didn't model myself on Isaac, obviously. But people in my family wrote. My father was a journalist as well, and you know, started off as a reporter and became a newspaper executive. In fact, it was always my determination not to be a journalist. I was going to be an academic, but you know, the ranks of journalism are filled with failed academics. Here I am.
What line of academia would you have pursued?
I was in a PhD program in history and American studies back in the early 80s. And I just, you know, they've been saying for decades that the liberal arts was dying in the U.S. And I guess they haven't been wrong, as recent articles about trying to get university faculty to work for free have demonstrated. But I was reading those articles and I thought, you know, I'm pretty good at this, but my work is also derivative and I can see, you know, spending the next 20 years trying to find a place that I'd want to live in a school that would have me. And it just seemed too much for me. And I thought I would try to do something else. And for a long time, I thought journalism would just be something I knew how to do. I grew up at a kitchen table listening to my father talk about it every day. Unlike my sister, who went to journalism school, I had no training except what I learned from my father. But I got a couple of jobs, first at the Chicago Sun-Times for less than a year, and then at the New York Times. And, it wasn't my passion, but my passion was food and wine and beer at the time. And I was hired in national news and used my spare time. I figured out I could earn extra money if I wrote some articles for the food section and started doing that. And over time, I migrated over there full time. And I've been with the Times food section now for more than 30 years.
Yeah. Your curiosity, I guess, leads to some of your brilliant journalism. And even before we get into your entree into becoming the wine critic there, I'm going to take it fast forward for a little bit into 2013. And I don't know if you even remember this because you write prolifically every week, but people might ask, why are you having this New York City guy, as we hear the horns in his background, you know, to give us the sense of place? Why are you having him on a North Carolina Central or based podcast? And, well, the fact is that I think, again, I mentioned you as an unbeknownst mentor to me, but I think you helped set my path based on your article in 2013, you wrote about the Triangle, and I was telling, you know, Max about it, and he remembers this article. You would have been here, I think, maybe just started.
I moved in 2013, yeah.
Yeah, about this great article, and it's timely even now in terms of the players that you mentioned there, like Matt Kelly and Ashley Christensen. We talk about Jay Betzky's and stuff like that. And I want to know, I guess how that came out was that you knew Noel Scherr, who started Cave Tarot. I wanted to hear, like, is that what brought you down here to write about the Triangle?
I actually had a couple of friends there, but right around that time, I did a couple of book tours around the country, and it really struck me how, you know, our impression of wine is something that belongs in the big cities. You know, it's bi-coastal, maybe a Chicago sprinkled in. But it struck me that there were pockets of wine lovers and great wine shops and restaurants all over in places that maybe wouldn't come immediately to mind. And of course, the Triangle has this these resources of universities and tech. And why wouldn't there be great food and wine there? But, you know, it goes even beyond that to, places I visited, Milwaukee, Birmingham, Alabama. And I wanted to recognize that, you know, this isn't just New York or California. It's a culture that is developing everywhere.
And that usually does coincide with kind of the faster growing cities, the development, like you said, with a great education system and tech and all that kind of just cultivates, like, all right, well, people are dining, people are going to go out, there's business happening. So that then leads to bringing the chefs to town because there has to be a thing to do for all this business that's coming up. And so they work together synchronistically or what am I trying to say?
Synchronistically.
It works together. But the great thing and what struck me about the Triangle was that it wasn't just as if, you know, you were importing chefs doing their thing from somewhere else, like like an Epcot Center.
Yes, you it's know. Not Vegas. It's, yeah.
No, it's, you know, you've got your places with their own cultures are expressing them in different ways. So it's just fascinating and wonderful to me.
Yeah, one of the things that you wrote about in that article 9 years ago now, and I think this was mentioned by Chef Kevin Callahan of Acme, and he's a former guest of the show, and he said, you know, one of the sea changes was the appreciation of our of the Southern roots being an agricultural economy. And as we move back to this, you know, how far your food has to travel before it gets to your mouth, and the appreciation of how much we have, you know, the bounty of goods to grow here in North Carolina. And then the chefs being proud of that really made the difference in becoming a new area and bastion for culinary excellence.
Yeah, and you know, we're still learning all the time. I'm blanking on the name of the recent Netflix series with Stephen Satterfield and Jessica Harris. Crazy.
You were speaking of High on the Hog.
Yes, by High on the Hog.
Stephen
Thank
Satterfield,
you.
Which yeah, you must check out.
That explored the African and African American roots of American culinary culture. That sort of exploration adds so many layers onto what we know and what we think we know. You know, it's just, it's so interesting to me, especially at a time when the whole study, not to get too political, but the study and understanding of history is under tremendous attack. And, you know, just in terms of a narrow area like food, where we can all learn so much and gain so much, and yet it's so threatening to so many people. It's just astounding to me.
And yeah, to your point, Matt, or to Kevin Callahan's point, is chefs in the South no longer had to apologize for embracing their Southern roots in a high-level, fancy cuisine, if you will. It's like, no, this is what all the foundations of all the culinary staples of our country were based off of. So why are we not embracing this anyhow? Yeah. And I think here in the Triangle, we really did a great job of that. And to Eric's point, doing it from within, it was like to do a football term for Shannon Healy over here, who loves it. We did not buy a bunch of free agents. We drafted this class.
Yeah.
And we drafted it internally and raised it up internally to make the Triangle's food scene kind of home base.
Dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, it's a plight of a journalist to parachute in for a few days and do a story. And I haven't been back since, and I'd love to come back.
Well, you have an open invitation, and we're happy to be your guides anytime.
Matt's got a cot that you could sleep on as well.
Well, there you go.
As long as you don't mind a screaming 3-year-old and 5-year-old, you know, it's fine. No, but that's what was so amazing.
You have to take your shoes off when you go into Matt's house.
Yes,
that's a whole
true.
Other thing.
But that's what was so amazing.
Thing to do.
Thank you. Right?
Oh, don't get it started.
Asian cult. We can thank the Asian culture for that. Yeah, we'll keep that aside for a separate podcast, and maybe we'll put that in at the show notes at the end. No, but that's what amazing. I mean, and you know, kudos to you for you had such a pulse on this region in what, like you said, you probably flew in for such a short time. So, can you clue us into that about how you? I mean, maybe that's the journalistic secret there, but like how you found the major players and got a real intimate sense of them in such a short time.
Well, I, as I mentioned, I had a couple of friends who were in the area and deeply immersed in wine and food culture. And I talked to them and, you know, that's part of journalism, and it's certainly part of wine journalism. And for somebody like me, I mean, I'm the only person at the Times really writing about wine and I'm basically, you know, my job is to cover anything of interest in wine. So that, I mean, nobody can know it all. So you end up doing a lot of cramming and then forgetting.
Totally.
It's almost as if, you know, you have to be a really good dilettante in a lot of areas and then rely on the expertise of the people who are extremely deep in particular narrow area. You know, I did my reporting and my research. That's another way to say it.
I wanted to connect the dots a little bit to that same point. So Matt and I recently, we were fortunate enough to sit in on one of your lectures that you did at the Charleston Wine and Food event based specifically on Chianti. And you went deep into your love of Chianti. We had, I believe, 6 different offerings to taste.
Yes.
A beautiful setting, a beautiful hotel. I mean, pull us behind the reins a little bit. How much personal research did you do the night before or leading up to so that you could, even the great Eric Asimov, like to be able to speak in front of what you would probably assume were some people that knew something about wine? Because Matt and I didn't spend anything. We got media tickets, but everyone else spent a lot of money to be
there.
We
spent a lot of work to be there, Matt.
Yeah, that's true.
Don't sell it short, please.
But still, what was your prep to do, say, something specific like that?
Well, I'm a very insecure person, and I tend to over-prep always.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a subject that I, you know, just came up with by chance. I sincerely love Chianti Classico and have been singing its praises for a few years now. So, you know, I know the producers and I know the background, but I talked a lot about the different communes and villages there, and that requires some prep work just to remind myself. You know, it's just one of the things. I don't really believe in omniscience, although a lot of wine people would have you believe they do know everything. And some of them do. They know an awful lot, but I've got a lot of great books on a shelf here. And I know how to look things up when I need to. And rather than thinking of myself as a great wine authority, I think of myself as a pretty good wine communicator, and maybe someone who can inspire interest in exploration. And that's really what I'm hoping to do, because there's so much pleasure to be had in wine. And because it's so complicated, people's focus tends to be rather narrow and repetitive. And there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, it's a little like going into a Chinese restaurant and always ordering the same dish. You're dealing with one of the greatest and most complex cuisines of the world. And if you find something you like, that's great, but there's so much more. And if you're interested in exploration, here's a few paths you can take.
You know, there's so many things to unpack there. Yeah. And one thing that strikes me, because you really are an ambassador of wine, a champion of wine, and I find it ironic that your professional title is Chief Wine Critic.
Well, let me stop you right there.
Okay.
Because it makes me a little uncomfortable, because I am decidedly not of the wine industry. I'm not an ambassador of wine. And, you know, I think that a lot of wine writers think of themselves that way. And I'm definitely not representative of the wine industry. It's not my job to, you know, see that it succeeds or to worry that it fails beyond what, beyond what is great about wine culture and wine in general. There's a lot of things that that I'm highly critical about in the wine industry and in American wine culture in particular. So, while I think wine is full of potential joy and pleasure and fascinating people and interesting history, and it's a way into so many important subjects that concern us as human beings, I'm also definitely not somebody who speaks for the wine industry or cares to.
Well, that's fascinating because of you, I am inspired by wine and learned so much. And I also have to think just candidly, like you have to think on some level that without people buying wine, being interested in wine, purchasing wine, you wouldn't be as an your income would suffer. I mean, plainly, right? That's what you do as being a critic. But the role of the American wine critic, as far as it pertains to you and others, you know, that are famously Robert Parkers of the world and the Wine Advocate and things like that. And I'm sure you're aware of this, but when I was working as a sommelier in New York City, you know, you would write an article, let's say, on Friuli, right? We knew that if that came out, the pour comes out, I think, on Wednesday, if I remember.
Yes.
Yeah. And so we knew, on Wednesday, we better get some Friuli options in here because everyone that's going to be dining here is going to want Friuli because you just wrote about it. So by want or not, you have an enormous impact and influence on the wine industry.
I'm not going to doubt that, but I think it's just important to for me to remind myself and for other people to know that I'm a New York Times journalist writing about wine, and so my responsibility is to readers, and if I can inspire them to try new wines, whether Friuli or anything else, that's a great thing, or get them to look at wine or any element related to it in a slightly different way. That's the aim, but it's definitely not to get people to buy wine.
Yeah, in parallel with when Matt and I started this podcast 5.5 years ago or so, we just kind of had a North Star mission statement of like, why are we doing this? And it was to make aware the North Carolina food and beverage industry while also giving perspective from our area about the food and beverage industry as a whole. And so while doing it, you know, that's why we can speak, we can break the rules and speak to the wine writer from, New York Times, because it still pertains to the food and beverage culture of North Carolina. Thank you for writing an article that helped really connect the dots easily. But aside from that, it still, whether you had done that or not, gives us perspective to say, okay, well, we are, as North Carolinians, going to connect to the rest of the world about this. And so in your perspective, you're connecting the rest of, really, because you have a much larger platform, you're connecting on a very large scale, your opinions, your observations, your insight. Matt and I are having this conversation a little bit, like, as for wines categorically, there's so much out there. There's so much that you know personally that you love. I mean, and I'm speaking about you, but I'm really speaking just about me. Like, I know things I love, and I know things that I dislike, but I also know the rest of the world appreciates. And so what do you do in a situation, and we'll just hypothetically just say oaky, buttery Chardonnay. That tends to be the thing that most astute wine lovers have a disdain for at times. How do you write about it without bias? Or do you? Or what is your opinion of writing about things that are not necessarily categorically for you?
I recognize that, you know, not everything that I love or appreciate is for everybody else. But I think that a critic's job is to make a case for a producer, a style, a grape, a place, and simultaneously make a case against a style that one is being critical of. So in the case of oaky, buttery Chardonnay, I would never tell anybody who loves that wine that they're wrong. Of course, people should always drink what they want. But that doesn't mean that I'm compelled to praise it because I have certain reasons why I don't think wines that are made in that style are really good wines. Now, you know, somebody might look at that wine through a completely different paradigm and say, you know, that's brilliant. It goes back to you reference my job title, Matt, critic. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean?
Yeah,
it means in the context of the New York Times, the title critic is given to people who cover some aspect of culture, whether it's books, movies, theater, food, dance, wine. And your job is to examine that culture, to comment with, you know, in an opinionated way, but with hopefully a way that's backed up by some sort of intelligent case to be made.
Yes.
And that's what I try to do. And it doesn't mean that I'm always correct or that I'm right for everybody, but I try to have a point of view that is not just flippant or reactionary, but tries to make a point about a wine or a style. And I hope that people then can react to that rather than just feel assailed somehow.
Yeah. Well, I think that, at least in my mind, and I feel like a lot of people have this impression or association when they hear the word critic, they think of the critic from, you know, Ratatouille, right?
Right.
And this very staunch, very, you know, strict person.
I was upset that Eric was not wearing a turtleneck when he got on.
And I guess the point
I purposely took my beret off.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
No, but the point I was trying to, you are not that. And maybe it's in a very elegant way that you write about wines, and it's often not in a way not in a punitive measure that you're taking in your article versus trying to highlight, like you said, a style, a reason for what people are making.
Well, I think it can be very entertaining to write, you know, a scathing review of something, but
especially
in the
if it's revenge fueled, that's fun.
Yeah. And sometimes there are reasons for it. You know, if you're talking about an expensive wine or a well-known brand or restaurant that's, you know, made fortune on its reputation. But most of the time, you know, especially with wine, you're talking about little known brands, you know, little family operations that nobody's ever heard of. And what's the point? You know, I try to reserve critical writing for well-known styles. And earlier in my wine writing career, I think I was considered a contrarian because I was going against what Parker and the Spectator, the styles that they promoted and which dominated American wine in the early part of this century. And I think that's changed in a big way, partly because of Parker's retirement, but also because of people through the internet being able to hear so many different voices praising many different styles and a younger generation of American wine producers who were influenced by the styles that Parker and the Spectator never really had time for.
Yeah, I want to just, for people who are listening and don't really know what you just referenced in a very simple way, in the 90s and the early first decade of the century, it was very popular to make wine styles, especially domestically and abroad, that were based on fruit forward and high alcohol and power. And now there's been, the pendulum has swung back to a much more reserved style that represents the place and the agriculture of the fruit being grown versus trying to manipulate a wine.
Yeah. And, you know, the great thing now is I think you can still find that big, powerful, over the top style, but it's not so dominant. There's a much greater diversity of styles available today.
I like that you compared what you write about versus, you know, the other publications. So many questions. Okay, first, I want to go back, and you're talking about, again, defining the word critic. Was there a time that you can remember where you really had to take a winery, a wine, a category to task for something that it was misrepresenting, or something that where you really put on your critical thinking and wrote in that way?
Well, you know, I think I've written about, or, you know, certainly in the earlier part of the century, I wrote critical pieces about the very high alcohol wines, the buttery oaky Chardonnays, the 16% Pinot Noirs and 30 Bricks Cabernet Sauvignon. I don't usually use that jargon, but I'll always remember a California wine guy referring to the 30 Bricks boys, you know, the all these young producers who are making these really overripe Cabernets. And
remember our Brewer Clifton days, Matt, when we spent a weekend drinking full bottles of Brewer Clifton Chardonnay and Pinot Noir
that were like above 15 and a half alcohol.
There's 16.6, if I correctly remember. It was insane.
Yeah.
But that was what was hot at the time.
Yes.
Yeah. And they were edgy at that moment.
Yeah. And, you know, nowadays I don't really find that many opportunities just to write a critical piece like that, because there are so many different, diverse styles available. And I find it much more fulfilling, and I imagine useful for readers to write about wines that I think are great that they may not know about, rather than, you know, trashing a style or...
Right. So then... back to the comparison thing, you know, Robert Parker made it very fashionable to write, or to have the scale of wines, the 0 to 100 point scale, 100 point being the best one can achieve. And then Decanter has their own, Decanter, another very famous, more UK-based publication, wine publication, has their own scale. You never subscribe to that scale. To the numbers rating. Can you talk a little bit about why and if you ever considered it?
Yeah, or could we create one for you?
The Asimov scale.
Well, I just never thought that the scale was useful. I definitely understand the attraction to people. You know, you go into a store and there's a wall of wines that you've never heard of, many of them in a label in a language you don't understand, and how the hell are you supposed to choose from among them? And the 100 point scale, or whatever scale you use, is a very easy solution, but it to me it just creates the illusion of security. So we know that a 95 point wine is better than an 85 point wine, but what does that even mean? First of all, it's rated in the mind of one critic. Second, it's kind of a universal scale. So the higher the score means the wine generally will be longer aging and theoretically more profound someday, and just somehow a more colossal experience. But I don't believe that's the way people drink wine. They drink wine matched to the occasion, whether it's something they just want to pick up on the way home, coming from the store to whatever they're cooking on a Tuesday night, or whatever they're having delivered, you know, to something easygoing with friends, to sitting in front of the television watching sports. And you know, each occasion would require a different scale.
Right.
And so what, I mean, there are nights where the 85 point wine is going to be by far the better choice than the 95 point wine. So what does that really tell you? Not a lot. The other thing is, if you're dealing with good wines change all the time. We know that they change over years aging in the bottle, but they change over minutes in a glass. They change from the time you pour them to, you know, the time you've poured your third glass, and as the temperature of the wine changes, as you have it with food or depending on your company. So what does that number really signify in the end? How does it really help you? I've always likened scoring good wines to a game of musical chairs. You know, the music stops and you have to slap a number on it, but things are going to change again. And so you've got a snapshot of, to use another analogy, you've got a snapshot of the sky at a particular moment, but the sky is going to change, and so is the wine. So for me, you know, scores and tasting notes take out the human element. You know, if you go to a restaurant or a store, you don't need to talk to anybody, and it enables supermarkets or, you know, whatever kind of impersonal shopping experience there might be, because they're giving you this in this theoretically objective feedback, whereas it's always better and you'll always drink better if you go into a dedicated wine shop with people who care and talk to them about what your occasion is, maybe what your taste is, if you can describe it, and pick a wine that way rather than just relying on some app or score.
Do you hear that, everybody?
Yeah.
Local retailer wine shops. Go find a local wine shop where you can have a conversation with a human being who can understand
who cares about wine. So yes, it has to be a good shop.
I was just going to say my sales manager from Southern Wine and Spirits 12 years ago would have hated that answer. He would have thrown up in his mouth and said, no, we need shelf talkers on everything because people are sheep and they need to know that 95 is better than 90 and that Eric Asimov says this is the best, so buy it because he said so. That's why.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, not all wine buyers are the same, and the wine market is segmented. So there are always going to be people who, you know, basically they don't give a shit about wine. They're looking for a pleasant alcohol conveyance system, something that is inoffensive and you catch a buzz and that's fine. And the cheaper, the better. And there's a lot of mass market wine that's sold on that basis. And, you know, if they want to put scores and shelf talkers on wines like that, you know, great. It's like, you know, it's like comparing orange juice or fast food burgers or something. There maybe there's a difference, but not really. But the wines that I write about and the audience that I write for is not that audience. They're wine. I'm writing about wines that are, in my opinion, generally expressions of culture in one way or another, and therefore are worthy of discussion and are of interest for reasons beyond the pleasant buzz that you will get regardless.
Right, and so that's I think precisely the point is the people that we're talking to right now that are still listening to this podcast and they're reading your article are the people that are interested and then have a decided interest in wine. And what confuses me about that and you maybe you can help answer this is there is still so much bias even amongst the somewhat knowledgeable consumer, right? Oh, I don't like oaky Chardonnay. Oh, no, I don't want rosé. Oh, I only drink red wine. And I can't find the historical reason. And maybe it is part of the scale. Maybe it is part of the, you know, in this country being a bourbon country, bourbon palates for a very long time, maybe it's the fact that, remember, like, if your grandfather drank vodka, he drank Smirnoff vodka, and I drank Smirnoff vodka, you know. So is that parlaying these people into their wine choices and their I think to use a word, their monochromatic thinking about it?
I don't think it's it stems from wine, as you suggest. It's really, you know, we're all kind of brand oriented, partly because that's the way, you know, American capitalism works. You know, you used to, when people smoked, you know, you smoked Marlboro or you smoked Chesterfield or whatever. And that's what you did. You didn't, you know, you didn't sort of go from one to the other just to because it was more interesting that way. You know, and, you know, maybe you were a, you buy a Ford truck and somebody else buys a Dodge truck. It's, you know, it's a little bit like rooting for teams in a way. And in, that translates in wine because it's so much more complex that you adhere to a style rather than a producer. A
yeah.
Although I know people who do, you know, buy by brand, but yeah, I drink rosé only in the summer. Or I drink oaky Chardonnays, or I'm a red wine guy, or, you know, people adopt these positions to simplify what is very complicated. And also because, you know, we've all had an experience where, you know, maybe we've had a bad rosé or we drank too much red wine and got a headache. So the, you know, the extrapolation is, oh, I don't drink wet red wine, I get headaches.
Right.
So, you know, I do a monthly column called Wine School, which is intended to get people to teach themselves really about wine. I suggest three bottles every month and give some alternatives if they can't find them. People buy them and drink them, and then we discuss them at the end of the month. And a lot of people send in their comments during the month and raise points, and we talk about it. And one of my continual points is that you can't ever decide you don't like something because you've had it once. You've got to return to it because there are so many variables. You know, I've done this myself. Tastes change. You might have had a bad bottle. You might have had an argument with your spouse. There's all kinds of reasons that you might have a negative association with a particular wine, but give it another chance in another context. And maybe it's true. Maybe your taste, you know, you don't like Bordeaux for one reason or another. And it's not, you know, I never believe somebody who says that there's always a style of Bordeaux that you might like because it's so varied. You know, every time you narrow it down, there's a zillion more ways to narrow things down. But, and I try to tell that myself because I've decided I don't like things from time to time and I want to go back to it and figure out why.
I want to, play a little game here because this is fascinating and we've got Eric Asimov at our disposal right now. So we're running a little long, but before we get out of here, this is just kind of a fun hypothetical game. Let's just say that the most recent television contestant chef, whoever that might be, just won their season and they now were funded by, you know, Goldman Sachs or so to take over a new American bistro right there in the heart of Manhattan. And they also just gave you, Eric Asimov, a ton of cash to be their wine consultant to build this program, to get it off the ground, off the start. And they also said, Matt Weiss has to be your salesperson. And they're like, oh, we like this guy, you know, whatever. Our parents went to school together or something. So you got to buy some wine from this guy. This is more for all the wine reps out there. Like, if Eric Asimov was your wine buyer, what would you, Eric, be looking for right now on this list? What's hot? What are the regions? What are the styles? The producers, perhaps? Just like, what would you go, okay, bring me some of this, because this is what I'm into. This is what people should be drinking right now.
You know what? I would be the most horrible wine buyer in the world. And the reason is because I don't want to please anybody but myself.
Yes, that might be the best buyer.
And, you know, you might also might be a controversial buyer, because I love restaurant wine lists with a point of view. I'm not so interested in those lists that try to offer something to everybody. Just like a restaurant menu. You want a chef with a style and a point of view. And I've had this argument with other, with critics and the public. You know, there was one restaurant, there is one great restaurant in New York that was like the first sort of super well-financed restaurant to have a list entirely of natural wines. And I thought that was tremendous. Cool. And other people hated it because, you know, why can't I go in there and have a Bordeaux? Well, you know, if there are natural Bordeaux, you probably could, but why do you assume that you have the right to have whatever you want? You don't go to a Chinese restaurant and order an American steak. Why? Yeah. Because you're not going there for that reason. This restaurant has made wine a priority, and if you want to go, you know, have your Napa cab, there's a zillion restaurants that you can do that in, but at this place, no, you're gonna drink our way. Thank you. And that's how my list would be. I would find a bunch. It wouldn't be all natural, no, but there might be a lot, and there would be a lot of wines that I love, and ultimately, you know, it has to be subordinate to the food. So I would be buying wines that I hope would flatter the food and make every meal even more wonderful than it would be with this bright, shining new chef. And, you know, that's like the most general and probably irritating answer I could possibly give. Yeah. But
no, so dissatisfied.
No, just because the answer to your question, Max, is you want to know what he's into or what you need to have? Yeah. Read the fucking article.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, because
I know the other thing is that I'm getting, you know, I go from passion to passion. I mean, right now I'm in the middle of tasting a bunch of Spanish white wines, because over the last few years, I've just, you know, here and there, I've had so many interesting white wines from Spain. And we don't think of Spain as a white wine. You know, we think of red wine, Rioja and Ribera, and, you know, maybe Sherry or whatever.
Yeah.
So it just, you know, you reach like a critical mass and say, yeah, I'm going to just do a little collection of Spanish white wines that I really like. And at the moment, I kind of fall in love with these wines because I'm drinking them. And right now, that's all I can think about.
Yeah. Do you ever get pushback from the Times about like, oh, that's a little bit too heady, or let's not go down that path? Or is it carte blanche to write what you want to write?
Never.
About? Never.
You know, I think that, you know, from time to time, I think my editors would, you know, they want to make sure that that I'm writing for all areas of the audience. So, you know, if I get too nerdy in an article, you know, I might follow that up in the near future with doing a, you know, a kind of a wine 101 piece. Yeah. You know, directed at younger people just getting into wine, maybe. But I'm a pretty good gauge of that myself because it's such a general audience. I try to, you know, if I'm going to write a column on a wine that is very sort of
heady,
you know, expensive, narrow, available to only a few. Or expensive, I'm going to follow that up with writing a much more general article about something that is more widely available. If I write something about Australia, I'll do something about Italy. I just try not to, you know, get too overwhelmingly concentrated in one area.
I have to ask, this is again just a dumb question, but Matt mentioned at the very top of the episode that we have had on in the background your uncle's rendition of Foundation, the novel that he wrote, I guess, 78 years ago, right? It was a
series of novels,
correct? Yeah. That Apple Plus,
or a series of novels derived from a series of short stories,
right? Actually. Yeah, and it came out on Apple Plus. It's this beautiful series. We've had it on in the background, and as we're talking, it's like eye candy watching all this beautiful sci-fi. Isaac Asimov being one of the greatest sci-fi novelists of all time, using the Robert Parker scale. What score would you give? How much did George Lucas rip off your uncle?
I can't answer that. I've never been a Star Wars person.
Really? You didn't get into the, you were like, my uncle did it right the first time.
No, I was an original Star Trek fiend. Ah. Loved it.
Okay.
Star Wars, you know, I like Westerns, and that's, you know, yeah. Star Wars is,
should watch.
Roddenberry famously described Star Trek. It was wagon train to the stars.
Exactly.
But it was a little bit, it was like more intelligent than that. I shouldn't say that, never having seen the show Wagon Train, but
you dig The Mandalorian. The Mandalorian is like a ripoff of like 60s, 70s Westerns, yeah, set in sci-fi land.
But, you know, it's after a while, you know, there's so much out there in popular culture that I would love. And I find, you know, you have to kind of strip what you go after, because otherwise you can't absorb it all. You know, yeah. I have this discussion with my wife, you know, if I read all these magazines, I'll never be able to read a book. If I pursue all of these hobbies, I'll never have time to pursue, to do any of them well. You know, it's hard to know. I will say that, you know, Apple did an amazing job taking a story that is extremely difficult to transfer to visual arts. You know, if you read the original books, they're almost all dialogue,
yeah,
and plot. And, you know, how do you add character? How do you, and I think, you know, I can't speak for my uncle or for his daughter, my cousin Robin, who really shepherded this project along, yes, for years.
Producers, yeah.
But, you know, to be able to adapt something that started in the 1940s to current sensibilities about diversity, and I just think it's amazing.
It is pretty awesome that it's timeless, yeah, in that it's so future forward that it really didn't matter. Taking the timeline out of societal ideas, it didn't matter. Rather than talking about it happening thousands of years ago or a millennia in the future, it's still just talking about people. So that was,
you know,
pretty cool.
And but they had a choice. I mean, they could, if they wrote it, you know, made a sort of an exact reproduction of a book, it would have been a great period piece of concerns that were, you know, they were larger than that time of history, but they're also very much rooted in that history, and they've sort of adapted it to modern concerns. And I guess you could criticize that if you wanted to. I would love to imagine what Isaac would say if he'd see it.
Which is why the joke is that when you watch Star Wars, everyone's hair is like from the 70s. Like their hairstyles are all from the 70s, even though it was long ago in a galaxy far, far away. Yet Mark Hamill still had a nice feathered look to himself. So, yeah.
You know, our imagination, even in great imaginary projects, our imaginations are limited, I guess.
Well, this has been great. I maybe you'll come back, because I still have so many more questions that I want to ask you. But I could not leave this interview, or I'd be remiss if I did not pridefully notice that at this time of Passover, on your behind your left shoulder, you had a perfectly bottle of Manischewitz there.
That's right. Good eye, Matt.
Somebody gave that to me, and you know, I kind of, it's almost like a trophy.
Right.
It's better off as a visual object than it is as an embodied object. As a drinking one,
yeah. Absolutely. You know, and I'll say in summary, I guess, you, whether you want to say it or not, I find you as a champion of wine, and I think you are for a lot of people, that you inspire wine drinking. And what I really admire about you is the breadth of which you cover, and the openness to try all wines and all styles of wine, and the inspiration of other people to do that. So in summary, I hope if you're listening to this, the one thing that you would glean from it is that, like Eric said, try every style of wine. Don't just try it once. Try it multiple times so you can make a educated decision about whether you do, in fact, or no, don't like it. But other than that, you'll take that. Awesome. Other than that, for those of you out there, please go follow him on Twitter. It's at Eric Asimov, right?
Exactly. And Instagram.
And on Instagram. Yeah, probably more important these days. Also, follow him on the New York Times. He writes articles weekly and also has some great publications and books out there. And go follow Eric Asimov, and you will drink extremely merrily.
Thanks for listening to the NCF&B podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes, and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.